Welcome to Gym Shorts Podcast. I'm your host, Kathy Smith.
Today, we're talking with 2008 Minnesota Teacher of the Year, an educator with a master's degree in curriculum and instruction, his doctorate in teacher leadership, and work as an author and presenter, Dr. Derek Olson. His 33 years of teaching experience has been at both the elementary and middle school in social studies and science. Today, we're going to walk through the transition students make from elementary to middle school and learn more about current thinking in social studies education. First of all, thank you for joining us, Dr. Derek, and welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And please just call me Derek.
Okay. All right. Well, you deserve it after what you've done with your career, but we will be informal and call you Derek.
Thank you.
Derek, so first we always like to ask, what is your favorite children's book and why?
Well, there's so many, it's hard to name one, but I think the easiest answer is probably Where the Red Fern Grows. It's an amazing novel by Wilson Rawls. I think it's my favorite because when I read it, so beautifully written, and when I read it the first time, it's the first book that impacted me to tears because of it, just the power of it. And over, you know, the 5 decades since, I've had the opportunity to read it aloud to many, many students and see it have a powerful impact on their lives as well. And another interesting thing, given that it's about a young boy about the age of the students I teach, it is also currently a really good reflection for me on how much what it means to be 10, 11, 12, 13 now versus in rural America 50 years ago has really changed.
Yeah, I know. In fifth grade, my teacher read that to us, and it was the first time we had ever had a male teacher. And like you said about, you know, getting tears, he would cry. We would come in from lunch and listen to the story, and we would all be crying. He would cry and the kids would cry. And it was just such a wonderful everything. I mean, the story was beautiful, having a male teacher showing us emotion and that it's okay, and just fabulous. So I love that you chose that.
And of course, you know, we've talked about crying. It's not a depressing book. It's a wonderful book full of a lot of great adventure for anyone who hasn't read it. But what I was mentioning about the way kids have changed, I think, you know, in that story, the boy saves up for over 2 years to buy these little puppies. Yeah. And think about, you know, now when kids want something, all they need to do is go to Amazon and it shows up next day delivery.
Yeah.
It's a really different time we're living.
It's a different world. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you, Derek. So can you just let us know, why did you decide to become a teacher? What keeps you, and then what keeps you going after 29 years?
You know, it's sort of funny. When I was in college, I had absolutely no desire to be a teacher. I was an economics major at St. Olaf. Actually, that's what I graduated with, an econ degree. Oh. And my goal was to graduate and go make a lot of money somehow in the business world. And during my senior year at St. Olaf, I went on an abroad program to Asia and spent a lot of time in Tibet and Hong Kong and Thailand in particular, in those countries, was able to spend some time with children in orphanages. And it just really, really had a big, big impact on me. And I came home not quite knowing exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew it was different than what I had been thinking. And ultimately, I just realized that I felt God was calling me to teach, and I still feel that call, so I'm still doing it.
Oh, I love that. That is just wonderful. And I love that you were inspired when you were away to do that. So awesome. Derek, let's talk about what some say is the biggest transition for young students as they navigate the move from elementary to middle school.
Sure. You know what? It is a big, big transition. And I think there's two reasons why it's such a big, I would argue the biggest transition students make in their entire educational career, other than going to kindergarten day one, leaving home for that first time. And that's because, think about it this way. Remember when you went, where maybe if you were in college, you had a freshman year in college, and sophomore year traditionally is the hardest year for kids in college. Why? Because it's not like freshman year. Now by junior and senior year, you've experienced transition. And so you know it's not going to be the same. And you've learned how to adapt to that transition. Okay. Well, kids have been in elementary school for 6 or 7 years, depending on whether they started in kindergarten and whether it ends at grade 5 or 6. And it is their first transition. Now, when they transition from junior high to high school later, they already know they can survive a transition, but this is their first one. They don't know that. That makes it very stressful. Secondly, the longer we're in a place, the harder it is to transition. And there is no place where you spend more time, unless you're a doctorate student forever, than elementary school, because it's 7 years. Middle school's at best 3, high school's at best 4. So the biggest transition is also your first transition. And I think those are the things that combine to make it the hardest transition. Plus, it's at a time when kids are trying to figure out who the heck they are and developing a different sort of relationship with their parents. All those things combine to make it a very, very challenging time.
Derek, in your experience, do you feel like this transition has changed some now versus when we were making these transitions? Or what should students expect?
I would say those are two really different questions. So let me, before we get to expect, let me talk about how I think it's changed.
Okay.
I think it's changed because, well, in a good way, okay? Because for instance, I'll just take Stillwater as an example. Stillwater used to have an elementary school and then a junior high and then a high school. And junior highs philosophically are very different than a middle school. A junior high philosophically is a mini high school. It's a junior high school. You get your schedule, you go to different classes. They're probably computer generated. You might have an advisor or a homeroom, but it's truly not much different than a high school. Middle school and the philosophy of middle school has really come about with all the newer research on the importance of social and emotional learning and how that impacts students. And in a middle school model, it there really, really, really is much more of an emphasis on that this is a transition, on what is unique about a middle school student that's different from a high school student, that's different than an elementary student, and how do we specifically meet those needs, and how do we make sure no one falls through the cracks? I know that later you had mentioned you wanted to talk, there was a question you wanted to ask me about, potentially about Wolfridge and social identity. Social identity is so huge in middle school, and it's about that group belonging. So in most middle schools, there is a part of the day that's not social studies or it's not science. It's not an elective. We have called it different things, connections, advisory, pony time, but basically it's about creating a space that is family, a place of social identity for students where they know they belong. And just like in family, we might not be friends, but the things we're spending that 30 minutes out during the day are not academic. They are about helping kids feel connected and belong, and also a chance for one adult to really, really make sure that kids who need something, you know, to check-in connects with the kids and really make sure they're not falling through the cracks. A final key component about middle school versus junior high, which I think is the answer to your question of what's different. So in a middle school, typically you're in teams or houses. So even though we, for instance, have 350 middle school sixth graders at Oakland Middle School, they are divided into two teams, and there's 5 core teachers and then some specialists who have those kids. And we meet every week and talk about those kids who need support and how can we help those that are struggling? How can we meet the needs of those who might need some extra challenges? And with the idea that no one falls through the cracks. And finally, again, a little bit of we really spend a lot of time at the very beginning of the year, those first couple of days, really, really, really teaching the kids about what middle school is, as opposed to start saying, today, here's your syllabus, and now we're going to start with, you know, page 1 of the text, which would be much more of an appropriate high school approach.
Right, right, right.
So those are some of the ways I think it has changed. And I think that, and actually our goal is, by the time the kids actually start truly having to get to their classes and be learning academics and be held accountable for being there on time, it's like day 3. And by then they're like, come on already, let's go.
And they're ready to go.
The stress is gone. They're chomping at the bit. They're ready to go. They want to learn.
That's awesome. And it's so nice that you're setting them up for success that way. I mean, that little time that you do spend at the beginning is just so foundational.
Oh, it's huge. And I think that there can be a temptation to look at all of the state standards that you're supposed to teach and think, okay, you can't miss a minute, jump in. But the quality of the minutes that you spend by taking that time to get kids feeling, if you're nobody who is doesn't feel safe and comfortable is going to learn at their best at their best level. We still are physical beings with a flee and flight response, and if we're in any way feeling the need to flee or fight or just in not feeling comfortable, there is no way our brains are engaged.
100%. So further to the question, and maybe we've already answered this, but in that case, then what should students expect? I think we've kind of been talking through it, but is there anything
so,
more?
So you mean like students who for whom it might be they're coming to middle school for the first
yeah,
time?
Yeah. What would you say? Okay.
Well, I think that a couple of things. One, for parents is just to remember that kids, middle schoolers are extraordinarily resilient and they will survive. And sometimes I think parents are more stressed about their baby going off to middle school than the kids are.
Yeah.
And kids will sense that stress. So one of my big advice to parents is, it's just, you know, it's trust that your kid will be, your student will be okay, your child, your baby, and don't let your stress be a burden they need to carry. Because we do see that a lot, you know, when it's back to school night and the kids come in with their parents and you can just see the stress on some of the parents. Now, if it's their third child and they've been there twice, you know, it's completely different. They come in, hey, Derek, how are you? This is Joe and blah, you know, and it's a very, very different experience. So, and secondly, know that, again, I can only speak for our, of course, our middle school, but know that the goal isn't a sink or swim mentality. It is to throw your child every single life raft, I mean, every single life preserver, and teaching them how to swim and all those things to make them float and be successful and keep their head above water. The hard things are the things that kids get scared about are their schedule and their locker combination. Oh my goodness. The first week of school, I will probably open 372 lockers. You know, and the reality is some kids will need their locker open between, you know, four, you know, whole bunch of times in a period of time. Other kids might need it once. Other kids will never need it. And that's okay. They're not shamed. We have locker keys. We try to teach them their code, but if it's bell's about to ring, we just put the key in and say, there you go, get to class, we'll practice later. We literally go out during advisory time and we'll say, okay, everyone, try your locker combo 10 times and see if you can get it without any mistakes, you know, that sort of thing. Let's all go walk our schedules. Everyone back in. And this is not when the seventh and eighth graders are in the hall. Nobody's in the hall. It's the middle of class and I can say, okay, everyone take your schedules out. See how quickly, without going into a full-on run, you can walk your entire schedule and be back here. Anyone confused about where one of the rooms? I don't know where science is. Hey, who can show them where science is? Okay, you two go together. And we just sort of have fun with it. We know what the things are that cause them the stresses, and we do our best to eliminate those.
Nice.
One particular thing that adds the most stress to their lives, which I know we're going to get back to later, so I won't bring it up, but it rhymes with phone.
Sounds like phone, looks like phone. Yeah. Okay. Well, we will talk about that shortly.
And one other question just about where to expect the stress. Honestly, yes. I think that the stress that kids come in fearing lockers, getting lost, those things aren't what end up causing middle sixth graders stress. What ends up causing them stress is social interactions with peers and if they get behind academically.
Yeah, basic. Yeah, most important things, especially like you said earlier, at that middle school level, the connection with their peers is almost rivaling their academics, right? I mean,
for most of them, it's number one.
Yeah. Okay, so Derek, how can parents and caregivers prepare and support young people during this time? We know kids are going to have more teachers in the day, homework changes, more responsibility, more social interaction. What kind of things could parents be doing at home just to support them? Like you had just said, it's so stressful for kids on the social emotional level. What do you think about that?
Great Great question. A couple of very important is I've what as you know, being a parent myself, these are things I needed to tell myself over and over again with my own students, and I see people struggling, parents struggling with this. One thing is, first of all, patience. It's really important to remember that 10, 11, 12-year-olds, it's their job description to act 10, 11, 12. It's our job description to let them know where boundaries are and what happens when you push them and cross them. But we need to remember to do that in a way that under we're in the back of our mind, instead of being overwhelmed, I can't believe my child did this and all that, that we realize what they're doing is age of, all this about the boundary pushing, the testing, the doing stuff where we just want to bang our head against, well, that is age appropriate for their non-fully developed frontal lobe in their brain and where they're at. And we just need to stay calm and help them through it. I'm not saying be patient and say, oh, that's okay there. No. Our job is to let them know when they've crossed what the boundaries are, when they've crossed them or gotten close, and what happens when you do. But we don't need to be exasperated and think my child's a failure, or more importantly, that I'm a failure as a parent. And I think that's unfortunately where I see parents go a lot when there's repeated behavior of their kids, that they're a failure. No, they're not, because not everyone learns a lesson the first time.
That's
So
right.
that's one huge thing. I think another thing that I see that I wish a message that I wish it was easier to get across to parents is they really need to believe in what their child is capable, and in a gradual release of responsibility from them to their child, that their child will become a self-advocate for themselves. I can't tell you how many emails I get from parents that there is absolutely 100% no reason why their child couldn't send it. And I know as a parent, it's a lot easier
Just do it.
just to do it. 100%, it's a lot easier. But, and I'm not saying that parents shouldn't email student teachers, they absolutely should. But as far as what can parents do to prepare their kids for middle school and help
Sure.
them be successful, is every opportunity that you have to think, I think they can handle this next step on their own, let them try. And finally, it is a-okay if your child fails and makes a mistake. If they fail a social studies test in sixth grade, which by the way does not go on their academic record, or if they do something really cheat, they cheat and get caught. These are the sixth grade is the time to learn. In middle school is the time to learn life lessons when it's not the end of the world that the life lesson happened. And I think that sometimes kids, parents, we can so much not want to see our children fail that we keep them from failing and they never learn how to bounce back. And that's so important.
Such an important lesson all throughout our kids' lives and even ours, you
And it's
know?
hard, right? We love them. We don't want to see them fail, but sometimes that's the best way to learn. Now, those aren't really big tips as far as those are not like how to walk something you can walk away with for day one to help your kid be more successful in middle school. So in that regard, the one tip I would give is we'll get to fall conferences and we'll have parents who said, I had no idea my child had 15 missing assignments or whatever it is. We ask them, okay, back to the kid's job description. It is
Yeah.
not a 12-year-old's job description, unfortunately, to be really forthcoming and honest. I mean, we wish it would be how they would be wired, that they would say, yeah, since you asked, mom, I have a lot to do and I probably shouldn't game on my computer. Well, if they know that you are not going to check and they would rather save the world 10 times during the next hour on their computer game versus beat their head against the wall with some math that they don't quite understand, and you ask, do they have any homework? The answer probably is going to be no, and they're going to go game, right? Okay, so what can parents do? Make sure that you yourself are checking whatever online platform there is that lets kids know where they're standing. In Stillwater, we have Schoology. Parents can have their own account. Parents can sign up for daily missing or weekly missing work reports that sends them an email if their child's missing one assignment. If they can't figure that out, there's a great helpline that they could call. It's the help desk. It's hard to miss on Stillwater's website. The gal who runs that is phenomenal. We had her kids in her son a few years ago. She's just wonderful. And if even if that seems to be hard, you can always have the child log in and just show you, okay, let's see where your grades are. And if they're struggling, then you can help them get on top of it. They're not ready for that full release of responsibility. However, if they aren't struggling, then release. If they are getting A's and have no missing assignments, then stop asking them daily. Tell them you're impressed with their responsibility. It is so impressive, and they are so advanced for their age in this regard. And you want to reward that with praise and trust. Now, if their grades slide, then you get back in the game.
Yeah, and I think you're spot on. I mean, the more we can scaffold our kids, and the more we can lift them up to where they are independent in middle school, especially, that sets them up for so much success. But also, when they're not there yet, you're saying, hey, that's okay. You're not there, but this is how we can start moving towards that, and then gradual release of responsibility. I love it.
And you mentioned another key word there, scaffolding, especially if you have more than one, if parents have more than one student. You know, not all kids in the same family are going to mature, develop, and have the same academic and organizational ability as other students, as maybe even their own siblings. And so recognizing that what worked for one might not work for the other.
Important.
How much oversight they need to be successful academically, but also even in how you might give consequences. I remember seeing a great interview with baseball player Joe Mauer's mom, and she was talking about raising three boys, three, you know, high-powered, strong-willed, athletic boys. I think it was three. And the funny thing was that the consequences they needed were so different. There was one for whom, and I don't remember which it was, to send him to his room was the best thing could ever happen to him, because he just likes to be alone in his room. For another, that would have been the biggest punishment of all time, so that worked. And for a third, an extra chore was the ticket. So, you know, each one of her kids had, she, even in consequences for fighting in the living room or whatever they weren't supposed to do, you go to your room, you do the dishes. I mean, and recognizing that kids are different, and we need to differentiate one, and two, that they will grow at the same, at different levels, and that's where scaffolding comes in.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, I don't know about you, but I come from four girls in our family and very different motivations. So,
sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, so let's go to that awful sounds like, looks like phones thing. What are your thoughts about screens in middle school?
Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, screens obviously involve a lot more than phones, right?
Right.
And we have, you know, the students at our middle school all have their own Chromebook, I'm not anti-technology by any means. And I love that so many of the things we can do academically on using technology, and the fact that the kids each have a Chromebook is fabulous. I will tell you that mid this past year, we finally got an oversight program called APARA that allows me as a teacher to be able to see all 30 screens of the kids in my room, and little mini screens of my computer, and send someone who's not doing what they're supposed to a little message, or just freeze them out. Or let's just say I don't want anyone on their screen. We're going to be doing an interaction. I can just literally freeze all their screens for 20 minutes and just make sure that no one's somehow doing anything. It's nice. And the fact that the kids know that really has reduced them using them in a for things they shouldn't be on during the day, which is great. And so screens definitely have a place in the classroom. Much of our instruction, many of the fun projects that the kids can do involve screens. So I'm certainly not opposed to technology at all. The biggest issue is social media. So it's not screens, it's social media that's the problem.
There you go.
And to the goal at Oakland Middle School is for kids' phones to be in their lockers from the time they get there to the time they leave. If we could be 100% successful in that, which is very, very difficult, it would be fine. Because if none of their peers have access to social media, then they're not missing out on anything.
There you go. Okay?
So if we can get, but the problem is, if there's this, all of a sudden you got 20% of kids that have figured out a way to sneak their phones, then it's the pull gets huge more. The other huge problem we have in middle school, I mean, ask any middle school counselor or administrator, and 75 or more, I don't know what number they tell you, but I know it's way over 50% of issues they need to deal with, student-to-student interaction, are related to social media issues that took place outside of the school hours, but get brought into school.
Interesting.
Like, so-and-so is going to fight so-and-so because they said this on social, on Instagram last night. That kind of thing. It is just such a distraction. And it breaks my heart for these kids. I mean, every single adult we know, virtually everyone will tell you middle school, junior high was a tough time.
Yeah.
Right? It's not an easy time to in life. Okay. And yet, for those of us who grew up more than 20, went through it more than 15, 20 years ago, at the end of the day, we could go home. And that big thing that could, that big bad entity yeah. that could be called middle school disappeared until it went back the next morning. Yeah. But it is 24/7 for these kids. They don't get a break from the pressures of social interaction. And I believe, and there's a lot of research that's showing that that is closely tied to the dramatic increase in mental health issues of anxiety and depression in adolescents in this generation. They never have a chance to be still and quiet and hear themselves think.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm going to sing your praises. That's just so important. And I feel like adults can kind of forget about that part of it, that social pressure that they have as middle school kids, and they're learning that side of it, and to have that bombardment, like you're saying, 24/7. I think you're so spot on with that. And I feel bad for kids today too, because, you know, we're adults and we even are impacted sometimes by social media and what's going on, but we have that hopefully fully developed brain where we can kind of set that apart and put it away while we're doing other things or tasks. And I
give such credit to the very, very few parents, and there's very few who have chosen just to not let their kid have a phone and social media yet and need to use my phone to call home. Yeah, and it's like they always can, right? And that's the other thing. We have parents that will balk at that a phone needs to be in the locker. Well, what if my child needs to get a hold of me? Well, what did you do when you needed to get, you know, I mean, they can always ask.
You ask to call your mom.
Go to the office every, you know, they can call home. They can call home from their any room in the building. And I would also encourage parents to monitor their children's social media. I mean, there's a pushback about privacy. Well, you know, at age 10, 11, 12, it's a device you bought and you're paying for the subscription and you're doing it primarily as a way to be able to contact your child when you want to. Those are the main reasons they have their phone. And I think it's important to set up when you give it to, when they get their phone, to not expect it to be a form of complete privacy, that you potentially might be checking their messages. And again, there's a lot of controversy about that topic as to where privacy, yeah. That is deserving to have experts on both sides talking about that. But you know, the parents who have absolutely no idea that what their child's doing on the phone device they've given their child, and you see the shock on their face when they're presented with screen grabs and such of something their own child did, is sometimes it's heartbreaking, actually.
Yeah. So Derek, there's new research about infusing literacy instruction with science and social studies and all those different curriculums that kids are getting in middle school. Are you seeing this push towards literacy crossing into every area of learning?
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say, I mean, there has always been research that would indicate that, but I would say there is more of a push as people recognize how many students struggle to read, and the more we can spend more of the day supporting them in that, the better. Let's take social studies, for instance. It's quite easy it's easier in social studies, to be honest. Right. We're more likely to have a textbook. You know, a really, I have taught science for many, 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 many years. in ways that really did not involve much reading at all. Social studies always has involved more reading because it's a very traditional way to learn history material. So for instance, how do you infuse literacy instruction to social studies? Well, when we're, let's just say we're learning about the Ojibwe, or we're learning about the fur trade. Okay, there's a chapter, and we're going to learn all those the standards, the content that the state says we need to teach. At the same time, as a good social studies teacher, I am also focusing on a process and a skill. So maybe what we're focusing on is the very, very important skill of summarizing or outlining or note taking, and those are literacy skills that I can teach using my content that become much more important for them moving forward than the content itself.
Okay.
If they don't remember who the four key chiefs of the Ojibwe were, or who was the entrepreneur in Minnesota who started the fur trade, you know,
not going to be
the lumber industry or the flower industry. That's okay. But if they can walk out of my class confident in how to take notes, how to identify big ideas versus small ideas, how to study for a test, how to summarize, how to read in context, all those sort of things. So in that, so as much as I love to try to teach in creative, unique ways, and like if we're going to, in our archaeology unit, instead of just reading about it, I bury artifacts in the long jump pit and the kids go out and dig them up and figure out what they are. That's, you know, that's my preferred way of teaching when we get to government unit, because civics is an important part of sixth grade standards. We do project-based learning projects where they create something to teach people who maybe are new to Minnesota or new to the United States on what they need to know to be a U.S. citizen. And they come up with games and podcasts and songs and raps and all sorts of really, really great things. And I love teaching that way. But I also recognize I have a responsibility at times to use the textbook, but not just to give them the content, but to teach them how to read better and how to interact with nonfiction text better. Yeah. And that's where those of us in content areas like science and social studies can really, really support reading is in nonfiction text. Because the reality is, most of what you have to read in life is not fiction.
Yeah,
it's nonfiction.
That's right. Wow. I mean, and you basically just answered the next part of my question on, you know, the social studies, especially in, like, we're just saying, how does that impact your teaching in social studies? Is it a trend, especially here in Minnesota? Are we seeing any huge shifts since the pandemic on more of a focus, or more for your level, the standards are more intense now about that literacy piece? I feel like, as a former educator myself, just seeing the difference of kids post-pandemic versus pre-pandemic and their learning, do you feel like they're just really hounding in on you guys for that now? Like, we really have to focus more?
Well, I think we should be. I don't feel an immense pressure. So, as in social studies, sort of that issue has taken a little bit of a backseat to a different issue in what's mandated in social studies. So every 10 years or so, the standards get looked at, okay, in the state. And I happened to be on the Minnesota State Standard Review Committee this year. It's some classroom teachers, it's people at the universities, it's people from different special interest groups, school board administrators, some people from Department of Education. It's a very, very large committee, and basically it's looking at the standards and how they need to change. Well, the last standards were in 2011. A lot has changed in the way people are collectively viewing the world since then. And so the real big change between the standards that we have been teaching to the standards that must be in, they're now law, and they have to be in place in classrooms fully by 2026, which might seem like a long way off, but given that there's things where things build, and so you have to, you know, it takes a while to implement new standards. The biggest change, and this has been hugely controversial, and it, to be honest, it splits right down political lines, is there is a much bigger emphasis on ethnic studies in the new standards, and with the idea that we need to look at not just the history, for instance, of white people in Minnesota, but the perspectives of all Minnesotans when we're talking about Minnesota. So if you were to take an event, let's say the U.S. Dakota War is a really, really good example. That is when in 1862, the Dakota Indians, some of the Dakota Indians were fed up with how they were being treated by the U.S. government, and they had some very, very legitimate beefs, and they started attacking. They started attacking to try to get their land back. Well, you can imagine if you were a settler, your perspectives on that would be that these savages were potentially going to burn your home and or whatever. And if you were Native American, you know, you'd been promised things by the U.S. government that weren't coming. The U.S. government was busy dealing with other issues and couldn't keep the promises or wouldn't. And it's your land that had been ancestral years and now you're fighting for it. And you can imagine those are both very valid perspectives. What we're trying to do when I'm teaching is to help the kids understand that there's always more than one perspective on an issue. I actually have them write two poems on that same topic, one from the perspective of a Native American and one from the perspective of a settler, answering sort of the same questions I am, I feel, I wonder, I hope for, and have them really understand. And of course, typically they'll only want to write one and they struggle with writing the other, and then recognize in the end that they were both very valid experiences of that event.
Wow. I love that approach too, Derek. I mean, when we force ourselves to look from a different lens, all of a sudden we view things in a different way. So to start middle school kids to start thinking that way just is phenomenal. So I love it. Good job. Let's see. What are your thoughts about AP courses? Is there a pressure for kids to take this curriculum?
So AP courses are in high school, so I don't have to worry too much.
Yeah.
As a teacher. But I mean, I teach courses. I've taught courses at the graduate level and seen kids coming from, you know, undergrads and seen them coming, you know, through high school. That, of course, in my own experience with my own kids. But I think that I believe there was a time when one of the key ways a high school was measured was what percentage of kids are in AP courses and what are their scores. And I think that, and those are a good measure of how you're meeting the needs of your high flyers. But public education isn't just about meeting the needs of your high flyers. And I think that there seems to be more of a understanding that kids are going to have different pathways in life. And a very, very, very expensive 4-year liberal arts education is not necessarily the right path for every kid. AP courses really, really set you up well for those that situation, because, well, first of all, you can get through faster. It takes, you know, there's some things you don't have to, you know, it might cut your costs a little bit and it looks good on your quote application. But I think there seems to be more push towards what really fits the need of individual kids. And yes, AP courses are really important for some kids, and they are ready for that in high school. Other kids are doing PSEO, where they're going off to Century or one of the other colleges in the area, and not necessarily taking super, super, super hard advanced courses, but they're taking courses that will give them some basic college credit, which is fabulous for what they're intending to do. And I think that there's even been a recognition that maybe for a while, the idea that someone might go into trades was something that was almost looked down on.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a recognition that supply and demand makes a big difference in the world. And there's some significant shortages in some trades, and you can make a, are you going to buy a yacht off what you make as an electrician? Probably not. But can you have a good living if you love working with your hands and be doing something meaningful? Yes. So AP courses are there. And but my sense, at least in Stillwater, is that they're not trying to just push people into AP courses for numbers. They want kids to be on the pathway that's right for them. In fact, I know, I believe in your podcast with Bob Manning last year, he talked about the Pathways program at the high school.
We did. And so thank you for giving us what your thoughts are on that. As we look a little further, I always like, as a former education teacher, I'm always listening to what are the buzzwords, what are the things that everyone's doing now. We hear more about critical race theory. Classical education in itself has always supported critical thinking. Is there a connection that way? And how can middle school kids be encouraged not only to learn this important skill, but also to share their thinking at a time when their maturity levels are still, they're still working on their maturity levels?
Sure. So when you say, like, what can we be doing as teachers, or what can parents be doing at home?
So basically, how can parents encourage kids to not only learn these important skills, but also, because that's what our goals are, right? In middle school and beyond, is to teach kids how to think for themselves and how to look at a situation and analyze, well, if I do this, most likely is going to be my result. Where sometimes, like you said, a lot of times as middle school kids, they're just playing around and finding their way, and they didn't know that, you know, maybe jumping into a pit could be dangerous. I don't know. I'm kind of going off here. I digress a little bit. I guess my question really is for parents, how can we encourage middle school students to start thinking for themselves and to be able to find some confidence while they're also learning that social emotional piece?
That's a really great question, because I wanted to make sure that's what you were talking about versus just like critical thinking as far as like a Socratic method in the classroom or something like that, like taking an argument apart or something. I think that, again, it goes back to letting your kids be as mature as possible and not being so afraid of them failing that you don't let them handle things themselves. They need to work things out in their own brain versus having us as parents and teachers constantly telling them. They need to experience what happens when you jump into a pit or whatever. I don't know I don't know why that was your example.
I don't know why. I was trying to think off the cuff, because I was like, okay, we could go both ways here. One, definitely, I would love to hear what your thoughts are as a teacher and expectations to the kids that way. But also as a parent, because I see a lot of kids, you know, on social media, whether it's TikTok or whatever, and they follow the leader and they do some really stupid things, and it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that you're gonna, you know, honestly, I don't know what you think about that whole thing, but I feel like that's a two-part question.
Oh, that's there's like I it's like so big and so small.
It's a lot.
Tight on that one. It's a lot. I mean, that whole like TikTok thing. Yeah. How do we convince them that, well, when they've seen that someone has gotten 2 million likes for doing something stupid, like pull off the soap dispenser in their bathroom. And then every middle school in the country is dealing with kids pulling soap dispensers off in the bathroom.
Yeah. No, it's.
So the think for themselves part, and how do we establish leadership? That is, which is a little different than critical thinking, but it is huge. I mean, so many middle schoolers are followers, and we do need more leaders. And it's because kids don't have the confidence. So when you can build up the confidence in your child by allowing them to feel, kids, 12-year-olds could run the world. The right 12-year-olds could run the world. Okay. I've always believed that. I remember eons ago when John Grisham wrote one of his first books, I think it was The Pelican Brief, I'm not sure, but it involved this 12-year-old kid who witnessed this murder. And he gets chased after, and so many people would write in reviews, Goodreads, or this book is unrealistic. A 12-year-old could never do all that. Heck yeah. There's half my class maybe could, as adults, never do that. But yeah. The other, or a few kids maybe, but yeah. A good chunk of the class could definitely do that in as 12-year-olds. We don't give 12-year-olds the credit for what they're capable of, and that's on us, not on them. If you think about it, there was a two generations ago in Minnesota, most 12-year-olds had jobs that if they didn't do them on a daily basis, the cows would die. If they didn't milk the cows, no one was going to, and the cow would die, or whatever happens when you don't milk a cow. I know it's not good, and the family would not get the money that they needed from that. You know, if they didn't do their chores, they knew they might have hated it, but they knew they were needed. As a 12-year-old, they had a sense of self-worth, of value. And the problem is, when we ask our kids to do something, we unload a dishwasher, we know they know we're just trying to. We're just spreading, you know, giving them some of the chores, but more importantly, we're trying to teach them responsibility. There's not, they know that's why we're doing. They know it's not because if they don't, it's going to
Just not
impact our
clean. Yeah.
extraordinarily.
Yeah.
And so response, feeling responsibility, accomplishing a task that matters, builds confidence, and confidence builds leadership. And so what we need to try to do in our kids is really, really, really nurture a sense of responsibility, and then really praise them for what they accomplish. And it needs to be outside of just traveling sports and activities. That is ultimately where our kids are getting that. And it's, and I'm grateful that they have an opportunity to show, to be responsible, to have other people, you know, counting on them as part of a team or an orchestra or a dance line or whatever it is. But then also the problem there is that becomes some, unfortunately, just by the nature of what that's become, their world becomes the center around which the family circles. And it
Yes.
used to not be that, right? It used to be the kid was contributing in a meaningful way to the family solar system. And now there's these kids go through middle school with the family going
All around them, yeah.
orbiting around their activities, at least from their perspective, which is really unhealthy.
Yeah. Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you for calling that out, Derek, because it's definitely changed since I was little. And I did have a job when I was 12. I was a paper, I had a paper out, and you know, people, if you didn't deliver the paper, they didn't get to know the news in Brainerd, Minnesota. And to them, it was important. So yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. So yeah, I think I kind of went through a different way. Christy was helping me write that. She's
I have a question for you.
yes.
How much longer are we going to go? Because I am at 6% on my battery, and I need to decide whether we need to pause. I need to go get a cord, or whether we're gonna. You think we're gonna like?
I
I
have
don't.
two more questions, and then so I don't feel like it shouldn't go much longer. But if you drop off,
I drop off.
no big deal. If you want to drop, you know, call me back when you have some time, and we'll just record the ending. But let's just see if we can get through it real quick, and then go from there. Sound good? Okay. All right. So thank you, Derek. You were part of an important sixth grade trip, Wolf Ridge. We talked a little bit about that. Can you tell us about that part of your curriculum and why it's part of the sixth graders' experience?
Sure. So when I taught sixth grade, when it was in the elementary school at Afton Lakeland, we would take students up to Wolf Ridge every year from Monday morning. We'd leave Monday morning at 5 a.m. and get back Friday at 5 p.m. We were with those kids for an entire week, 24/7. Now that we've transitioned to all the kids at the middle school, that trip isn't happening anymore. But I did it for 18 years, and I know that for many of the kids, it was really one of the highlights of their entire academic, you know, undergraduate career. And I think that it just was an opportunity for them to be in a completely different environment, to maybe explore parts, realize the ways that they were a leader or develop. There's ropes courses, and there's initiative courses where you have to do things like get your group over a wall. And it was interesting because sometimes you see that kid that sometimes was maybe a bit of a struggled with behavior in class become a leader in that situation. Or and kids really develop a sense of confidence as they manage to get across the zip lines and down the rope. And as far as some of the other things we do up there, like to learn about the Ojibwe in an Ojibwe camp set up where the kids are actually, you know, making wild rice, and getting some learning in the wigwam and doing all these things, or to learn about the fur trade while paddling a Voyager canoe on like, you know, across a lake was just, it was such great hands-on learning and such great opportunity for kids to develop a sense of social identity where they're belonging to a group there. And also to, for many, it was their first experience in nature and to experience that calming peace that, you know, nature can provide was really, really neat way to see the kids grow and mature. And we always did it in the fall. And so it was also a really great, we're going to be a team for a year and to really get to know the kids, you know, in a different way. Once you've helped a kid who really scared to jump off the top of a zipline tower to do it, when you're helping them with a math problem back in, you know, 3 months later, you have a different relationship with that child. So, and they do neat things there. Like they have jobs, like they have to do the dishes and they have that sense of responsibility. And then of course you come back from something like that and you tie it to academics. You have them do a Wolfridge journal where they're writing and reflecting and creating a product that has goes along with everything they've learned. It was a great experience. It's just a little tougher to do with 350 kids at once versus, you know, 50 or 75.
Our last question today is, Derek, where do you see middle school learning if you're looking ahead in the next 10 years? Is anything changing? Do you think AI is going to take over the world? What are your thoughts?
Man. Wow, that'll be a fun one to look back on in 10 years and see. Oh my goodness, it could go in so many different directions, right? I think about, like, you know, what they figure Amelia Earhart missed her, was off 1 degree and put her however many miles off of whatever island she needed to be on. Yeah. I think that everything is changing at such an exponential rate right now that it's so hard to imagine what it will be like. But I do think that we have dealt with, as far as education goes for the last decade, we have dealt with social media and, you know, independent devices having a huge impact on students learning and how we, and on the schools. And I think that probably the thing that will be have the biggest impact moving forward is AI, as you mentioned. I mean, that's really going to change how students get information, or already is, how students get information and how we can expect them to let us know what they actually know. It's really huge. I think that I have a feeling that there'll be a lot of divergence in what happens in education, and that there will be some places where schools look like this and some places that look like this, and they will be farther apart than they are right now. I think the difference is, you know, public schools have a mission to educate all comers, everybody who's there, and private schools have a different goal. It may be to prepare students whose families can pay for them to do so, to prepare their child for college. And I think that all schools are under some regulation. Some schools are, you know, public schools, and private schools face different charters and regulations as far as what. And I think that that's going to result in more significant differences moving forward than we've ever seen before. There will be schools that will say, nope, there's going to be no devices in the school, and they're going to be able to, you know, get away with it. And there's going to be other schools where it will be challenged in courts that kids have rights and deserve to have their phones.
That makes sense.
And so I think that divergence in what we see education looking like will be one of the biggest trends over the next 10 years, and that it'll be all over the board.
Interesting. Well, you know what? In 10 years, I'm going to look you up, Derek, and we're going to talk about this. We're going to see where we were right and where we were a little off base, but I agree. I think it's going to be a totally different venue altogether.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully we don't ever have an opportunity I think we're still recovering from the years of COVID, of the pandemic, as far as that's impact on education. And I think that hopefully that doesn't happen again in the next decade. And
crossing fingers again. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that globalization will continue to be a big thing. You know, the world just keeps getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
So
It will be very fascinating. So
it
hopefully
will.
both of us will be around in 10 years to look back and say, remember when?
Yeah, I'm teaching a graduate course this part. I'm co-teaching a graduate course at UWRF this fall, and you know, and I had some students from there in my classroom this past year observing, and I look at them and think, you know, over their 30-year career, what will education be like when they are retire?
Yeah.
And it's just hard to even imagine.
Yeah. Well, let's just hope it still looks beautiful and the trees and the beautiful lake behind you are still gorgeous and everything else.
Well, and the bottom line is kids will still be kids and worth our best efforts to educate them and raise them up into productive citizens and to reach their potentials.
There you go. Couldn't have said it better. Well, Derek, I really am grateful for your time today. It's very obvious why you were nominated and won the Teacher of the Year. You just have such a great approach to kids and helping everybody be excited about learning by the way you approach things. And we all should be so lucky to have a teacher like you. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to visit with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear more about your work and where you guys where you're headed in the future. I hope you have a very good academic year coming up.